are three big benefits that people are going to receive from the Down 40 Love podcast. Number one, you're going to be inspired. These conversations with great people like American film producer Hawk Koch are like positivity pills that give you the energy to go out and crush your goals. Number two, you're going to build resilience. Down 40 Love is a tennis metaphor for turning adversity into competitive advantage. On the podcast, we share stories, strategies, and actionable steps so that you not only stay in the game, but you elevate your game to the next level. And three, you're going to get better. Listen, there's nothing worse than wasted potential. As a leader, you already know that, and it's also your greatest fear. By listening to Down 40 Love and applying the lessons to what's going on in your life, you'll become a master at turning setbacks into bounce backs and much, much more. Are you ready? Let's go. Lou Weisbach is the CEO and co-founder of In Tickets We Trust and founder of the American Center for Cures. He also founded and was CEO of Halo Advertising Specialties, which became the world's largest promotional products company. Lou was named Man of the Year by Counselor Magazine and sits on several charitable boards. Lou Weisbach, welcome to Down 40 Love.
Renee, pleasure being with you.
Tell me, what did your early beginnings look like growing up in the Chicago area?
So, I had a wonderful family. My mom and dad, we did not have very much money, which was okay. That seemed normal to me at the time. And but surrounded by love, and my mom was an amazingly warm person who influenced me so greatly because everybody loved her. She was kind to everybody. And so she gave me an understanding of how to treat people. My dad was visionary and took on all kinds of challenges, loved to hang out with celebrities. So I saw another side with him that helped mold me as a human being. And then quickly early on, without understanding, because when you're 10 years old and 12 years old, you don't understand these things about yourself. I had an entrepreneurial spirit, which I don't really know where it came from, but obviously it was inbred. And I started a company that sold stamps at 10 years old called the Worldwide Stamp Company. And when I was 14 years old, a guy who really influenced my life by the name of Emmett Bryant, who was a basketball player who played in the NBA but went to DePaul University, he went to Coach Ray Meyer at DePaul and said, "I've got this young man, and he would like to work out with the varsity." And I ended up scrimmaging full court at 14 years old with the DePaul varsity. And so I had a lot of experiences very young in life, which gave me a lot of underlying confidence in my ability to go after anything and feel like I had a good chance of being successful.
Where did your parents come from? Did they grow up in the United States, or what's the background story on your family?
Yeah, so my mom grew up in a small town in Wisconsin. Her parents emigrated from Russia. Her grandfather was the mayor of a town in Russia, but Russia became unlivable for Jewish people at that time, and so they came here and basically gave up all their money to move, the old story, to move to America, to a place of freedom. And my dad had a similar story, but he was actually he was born, as was my mother, born in the United States.
Where specifically was your dad born, did you say?
Chicago.
In Chicago. Okay.
In Chicago.
I got it. So, Lou, growing up, who were some of your mentors and what lessons did you learn?
So, the first mentor outside of family was when I was 7 years old. I lived near Wrigley Field in Chicago, and I would go to every Cub game that I could go to. At the time, by the way, it cost 50 cents to get a bleacher seat at Wrigley Field. And so I could actually even afford that. And I was in walking distance. So one day, Ernie Banks was standing in the parking lot after a game, And I walked up to him, and he was incredibly kind to me. I can't even explain to you the impact he had on my life, because here I was, this kid, he had no idea who I was, and he would sit and talk to me endlessly. And so he had such an impact on my life in terms of how you could use celebrity to influence people in a positive way, and how important it was to be kind to everybody, regardless of who they are, and to be welcoming to everybody. So he had a really dynamic effect on me. As I mentioned before, Emmett Bryant, who played for the Boston Celtics, the fact that he went to Ray Meyer, the coach of DePaul, and asked him if he'd let me play, that was so kind of him, and, you know, also had a huge effect on me. Bill Clinton, later on in life, had a huge effect on me because of my involvement with him and running the Jefferson Trust for him, which was the largest donors in America, and watching how he had his ability to connect to people, to speak to people, his warmth. And here's the President of the United States. If I called him on the phone, he would call me back today, every time, which was just incredible to me. And every time he would see me, he knew what I was interested in, and he would say to me, I know what you care about, and I want to tell you what my thoughts are. And so those types of role models, you know, from early on in life, had a real material effect on the way I treated people and the way I tried to live my life. And the other person I would mention is, and it's actually a family, the Crown family, because I was coaching at a school called Ida Crown, which was a high school. And it was financed by the Crown family, who were one of the wealthiest families in America and the world. But they were driven by kindness and charity and trying to do things for people. And so I would say the combination of all those people had a real material effect on me.
That's amazing, Lou. Just rewinding quickly back to Ernie Banks, was this a one-off instance, or is this something that happened consistently in terms of your conversations?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that question. So it was not a one-off. It happened several times, but now I'm going to take you 14 years later. I was coaching the high school team in a preliminary game to a Chicago Bulls game at the Chicago Stadium, and Ernie Banks remembered me and was at the game and came and sat next to me on the bench 14 years later. But I'm going to take you to another place. Ernie Banks was in my skybox at the United Center, and he said to me, and this is many years later, he said, "Lou, you know, I'm kind of down on my luck," and he said, I really need a job. Do you have any ideas?" And I said to him, "What are you doing on Monday?" He said, "Well, I have nothing on Monday." I said, "Yes, you do. You started Halo. I'll see you Monday morning at 9 o'clock. And he came to work at Halo for the next 2 years.
Wow.
And as part of that, it's a great story just because it shows the connectivity of life. And when you're kind to people, as he was to me, how things tend to work out for you. This next story is a story that I always love to tell. So Ernie Banks and his wife and my wife and I went to Las Vegas together during that period of time. And we were at Bellagio waiting to be seated. And Jerry Jones, the owner of the Dallas Cowboys, and his son were standing waiting to be seated. And Jerry Jones walked up to me and he put his arm around me and he said, "I want to tell you about that guy," pointing to Ernie Banks. And I said, "Yeah, I'd love to hear whatever you have to say about him." He said, "He changed my life." I said, "How's that?" He said, "When I was a kid around 16 years old, my dad knew somebody who worked for the Cubs, and he got me to come into the Cub clubhouse, and I was a bratty little kid. And Ernie walked over to me and was so kind. And it made me realize what kind of guy I was and how kindness is so important. And now every year at Dallas Cowboy training camp, I have an Ernie Banks Day where I tell the story and I tell my players that as long as you wear a Dallas Cowboy uniform, this is how I want you to treat everybody you come in contact with.
That's amazing. Thanks, Lou, for sharing that.
Of
Now, I know you coach basketball. How did that come about?
That's a simple story. So I was a couple years ahead of myself in school. I graduated when I was 16 years old from high school. I played on the basketball team during that period of time. In fact, I was athletic director while I was a senior in high school. It's a crazy story. I put together a tournament across the city of Chicago with many of the best teams in Chicago that I ran as a senior in high school. And so, as I was explaining to you, I had some really unique life experiences early on, and which gives you a lot of confidence that you can kind of climb any mountain. And when I graduated from high school, the principal of the high school said to me, "Would you be interested in coaching?" And I said, "Of course I would. I'd love to." So he hired me at 16 years old and a freshman in college as the varsity basketball coach. And I was coaching guys that were older than me. And so it was a great experience. Again, something that gave me a lot of confidence in my ability to do things that are out of the box. And it really colored my career going forward.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned earlier, you know, that you've always had this entrepreneurial spirit and you're not sure where it came from. But you've also mentioned that you've had a few unique experiences, you know, when you were younger, that it appears have shaped the way you see the world. You know, are there any stories you want to share with us, you know, that sort of tie into this to this visionary lifestyle that you've created and really been able to execute at a high level throughout the course of your life?
I think that when you have experiences early on in life where you feel you've been able to do things that are not traditionally done by people at that age or in general, it kind of colors you to think that let's think outside of the box and think about things that not only from a business perspective, but from a global perspective and the perspective of mankind that can really change the world. And so that colored my thinking, and I became very open as I grew and my career grew to trying to do things in a different and unique way, but never feeling like there was a ceiling to anything I was doing. And so I founded Halo when I was 23 years old, which became because I was a salesperson for another company in the business, and we sold promotional products, logo merchandise. And I borrowed $3,500 from my mom, I should say. And obviously, I'm eternally grateful for that. And in the next 27 years, we went to market in a uniquely different way because it was an industry that at the time had 12,000 companies in the United States. And today there's close to 30,000 companies in the United States in that business. But basically it was an industry of people that would go around peddling imprinted products to corporations in general, but schools and every possible type of customer. But there were really no competitive advantages and there were really no brands. And so my experience of that really helped me was in treating people well. The people who came to work at Halo, they were family, and we just had a wonderful relationship, including, by the way, many of my ex-cheerleaders, my ex-basketball players. And we started organically growing, and we went from one person to 10 people to where 20 years later, we had 85 people, and I decided I wanted to go public, partly because we were in a lot of debt, but we had grown the company from nothing to the place that it was at that time. And people on Wall Street said, "Well, you can't go public. You're in a business. You're just a bunch of salespeople in a business that has no competitive advantages." And I said, "Well, but I think with culture and by building the brand, we can become a significant company, not only in America, but in the world." So finally, I was able to get a brokerage firm in Chicago to take us public. Mm-hmm. And within 7 years, we ended up from 85 employees to 5,200 employees and 55 offices in 11 countries. and most importantly, a culture that really was about treating everybody well, where people loved coming to work and people loved being together. We would basically be hugging people every morning when they came to work, and they would hug us. And it was a place where people loved coming to work and never wanted to leave. But you could do it in those days because culture was extremely important in those days to building a camaraderie. And then at the same time, we built our brand to be the biggest brand in the world in the industry, and we did it in a unique way by putting our logo in very visible public spaces, including I signed a deal with the Chicago Bulls the year Michael Jordan was signed by the Bulls to have my logo on the chairs that all the Bulls and their opponents' players sat on. And then we did the same thing in Major League Baseball, at horse racing tracks, in the National Hockey League, and in all types of places where all of a sudden this brand halo was on national television and on replays. In fact, if you look at the recent movie about Michael Jordan, you will see Halo, him sitting on Halo chairs all the time. And so we were able to, by thinking outside of the box, do things that nobody had ever done, to where we became a household name, and salespeople around the world would come to us and say, we want to work for you because you provide us with a competitive advantage that nobody else does.
What were clients specifically paying you for?
So clients were, in the beginning, we were selling promotional products for them, to them. So they would use, I really believed that when it came to advertising your business and what you're doing, that promotional products was, for most companies, a better spend than television advertising, radio advertising, billboards. And the reason was, is because what we provided to clients would put their logo and their message in front of somebody, but it would stay with them. In other words, if I sold you a pad of paper with my logo on the side of it and what we did, you'd have it on your desk for the next year and a half,
yeah,
2 years. And I felt at the time that this would give us a competitive advantage in trying to sell this as a marketing solution for virtually any form of advertising, because it would have a lasting quality to it that all other forms of advertising don't have. And the judgment was, it turned out that that was true. And our industry and our company blossomed. And we went from $22 million in revenue in 1992 to $770 million of revenue in 7 years.
So you were essentially selling to CEOs and decision makers in the marketing divisions?
To not only CEOs, but more often to different levels, people with budgets in major companies.
Yeah.
So our biggest customer at the time was MCI, and we would provide merchandise to them that they would give out to clients whenever they would sign up for their teleservices. We, for Montgomery Ward, which was a shopping store chain, we would provide them, if people would sign up for a credit card with them, that they would get a free gift, whether it be a watch or a boombox and so on. So anything that would help stimulate business, most often it would have a logo, sometimes it would not, but most often would have a logo.
So I love the fact that you started as a one person company, you know, and then you mentioned you grew to 85, and then you got scaled, right, like big time, to over 5,000 employees. What challenges did you face as an entrepreneur and leader, you know, during that time, you know, to make sure that you were staying at the ahead of the curve, you know, from a personal and professional standpoint?
Yeah, so the challenges were, like any other entrepreneur or anybody else that starts a business, that nothing goes straight up, and there are challenges in business all the time, and there are always going to be time, and there always are going to be those challenges. And what I realized very quickly was the most important characteristic, aside from the way you treat people, was resiliency, was being able to understand that things never go straight up. The best plans that you have go awry because things happen in the marketplace naturally and with competition that you didn't necessarily anticipate, and that you have to step back and be thoughtful and think about real solutions that you can do to be ahead of the curve relative to your competition. And so we had all kinds of challenges, including debt, because we never had any other investors until we went public. And so we had to grow the company on debt. And so we had an extraordinary amount of debt on the company. And there was always challenges with banks trying to make it through and to satisfy them in terms of our ability to repay and pay down debt. And ultimately, we went public more so because, not out of a design, but more so because I had to, because at the time I had a lot of debt. And to keep the company moving forward, really had to go public, and was very fortunate that we were able to do that. And I'm so thankful to the openness of the investment bank that we used at the time, but also our banker at the time, who was just incredibly thoughtful. And he looked at people in a different way. He was open to kind of stepping out of the box and lending money to people that he believed in. And he believed in their plan and their model, even if it didn't fit the parameters of the way the bank liked to lend money. So a lot to be thankful for, but certainly we had a lot of challenges along the way, but no different than any entrepreneur has.
I mean, where, this is more out of just personal curiosity, but how did you, accrue so much debt, being a promotional products company? I mean, was it in inventory? Was it in, in salaries to salespeople? I mean, how did that grow?
Yeah, so it grew, a lot of it grew just because as you're growing a company and you don't have any capital to grow it with, being able to, as you continually grow, handle the receivables. And payables, you're going to need more and more capital as you go from 100,000 in sales to 4 million in sales to 10 million in sales to 15 million in sales. And knowing there was no other investment in the company, it becomes difficult. And at the same time, I probably was spending more money. I had a family with two and then four children. And they were extraordinarily important to me, and traveling was important to me. And we took our kids all around the world and probably spent money that we shouldn't have been spending. And so it was a combination of debt that was derived out of lifestyle and building a business.
I appreciate your candor. What advice do you have for entrepreneurs who want to build a successful business?
My advice is to, number one, not think that there's anything unachievable, and dare to dream. And then the most important advice I would give, and it's probably more important today than even back in that day, is that you think out of the box and you make sure that you have at least a plan for real competitive advantage. Because without that, just relying on pure competition and your ability to compete in a marketplace where you have no advantage is a recipe for potential failure. But to the extent you spend a little extra time thinking about how you can compete in the marketplace that you've chosen and have a real distinct advantage in that marketplace, then you, if you're good at what you do and you work hard, and by the way, you build a good culture, which is another important piece to that, then your chances of success are really high.
So, Lou, as you know, every story has its fair share of setbacks, and you've mentioned how resiliency is the most important characteristic, for a leader and for entrepreneurs. Talk to us a little bit about your take on resilience and overcoming adversity.
So, I'd be more than happy to. So resilience really is the most important thing, and it was very important to me in my career, whether in coaching or running Halo. But there's no doubt that there's nobody in this world who doesn't have tremendous challenges in their lifetime, and whether it's in business or in health or just different things that are going to occur in your lifetime, whether it's in being mistreated by certain people. I mean, we all, and you see today, especially in America, what's going on, people are challenged more than they've ever been, and that's just always going to be there. It's not going to change.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yes, I've certainly had those things. I ended up leaving Halo after 27 years because our board of directors, I lost, because we, which I hadn't mentioned, we acquired 34 companies.
Mm-hmm.
During that growth cycle. And as a part of that, I ended up losing control of our board of directors, and our board of directors wanted to go in a different direction mm-hmm. that I was uncomfortable,
yeah.
I was uncomfortable with. And ultimately, I left the company, which was painful on the one hand,
mm-hmm.
but on the other hand, it was a blessing as I look back, because it got me to understand that to stay relevant in life, you want to grow who you are. You want to keep taking on new challenges. And even today, many, many years later, I left Halo 25 years ago. I am taking on more challenges in new industries. And I find it keeps you relevant. It keeps you young. It keeps you excited about life. And so, challenges and resiliency have been extraordinarily important to me in my life. I started a new company a few years at, well, I went, I should go step back. Right around the time I was leaving Halo, I was brought in by the Democratic Party, the Democratic National Committee, to be the chairman of the Jefferson Trust, which housed the largest donors in America to the Democratic Party, which at the time I felt very strongly about. So that was a great life experience, and I met so many amazing entrepreneurs in America, but also celebrities because of that. And so it kind of brought me into a new world. Then I went from there to getting involved in Las Vegas with helping to bring Major League Sports to Las Vegas, which brought me into another business because I realized the opportunity to finance Major League stadiums in a unique way, and started a company with several partners to do that. And I did that for 7 years, and that company was acquired by Morgan Stanley, and I ran it for Morgan Stanley for a 7 year period. And of course, the American Center for Cures, something which I care the most deeply about, is something that also came up at around the time I left Halo through my political contacts, and realizing that the only reason we don't cure diseases isn't that we can't, but it's that there's no real business-like plan to cure diseases, and that people keep running and walking for cures and throwing money into a system that's never worked and never will work. And so in the American Center for Cures, we have a plan that will have enough money, the right leadership, the right process, to once and for all get the job done. So, and I was watching, by the way, a story today about Olivia Newton-John, who I met through politics, by the way, and her mission on cancer, and she was one of the most remarkable people ever. And it, again, it just motivated me so much today to keep the fight going, just as she did after she dealt with cancer several times, lost her sister and her mother to cancer. And so there's really nothing that can't be done, and resiliency is everything, and using the down points in your life to help uplift you and stay strong and tough and keep having vision is extraordinarily important, because we are all going to have those times.
So to sum up your thoughts on resilience, Lou, what does Down 40 Love mean to you?
So, well, first of all, one of my closest friends in the world was the former head of the USTA, and we talk about tennis and competition all the time. But Down 40 Love, I would say I've had many down periods in my life where personally and business-wise, where my back was against the wall, and my instinct is that it's not over till it's over, and you've got to fight, but you've got to fight intelligently, and you've got to fight with competitive advantages and outthinking the market or outthinking your competitor. And I feel like on the American Center for Cures, something I care most deeply about, we're down 59 love, if that's a possibility. I know I'm kind of taking some creative license with tennis numbers. But the blessing that I've had in my life is I've been there before, and I've had very difficult challenges, and I've always felt that if I keep fighting, even though the odds are strongly against me, whatever I'm fighting for, that you can get the job done. And I feel that way really strongly right now. And in this year, which is a presidential election, the idea that curing diseases is the single issue, that is the exact same thing for everybody, black and white, rich or poor, Democrat or Republican, and can unify the country, which I think all people in this country would like to see. I think we're all sick of people on both sides of the aisle pointing fingers and trying to reach out to the extremes on both sides. The answer to American politics, which people are forgetting, is in the middle. The undecided votes are in the middle, and we think that the American Center for Cures and getting everybody behind a mission that will wipe out Alzheimer's and Parkinson's and diabetes and pancreatic cancer and mental illness and heart disease, the unifying effect of having a real plan with enough money to get that done is so timely right now. So we're pushing every button that we can to get that to happen. And I'm excited about the challenge, and I know it's Love 59, we're going to win the gold cup in this situation on behalf of all Americans and the world.
So, Lou, outside of, flipping that setback of being down 59 to Love, where it's working in your favor and you're up 59-0, what is an ideal future look like for you personally and professionally 5 to 10 years out?
So, the most important thing is to win that match about curing diseases and having a real legacy to point to and get people to understand that there's nothing they can't achieve, and especially if it's something that's to the benefit of all people. And also treating people like you want to be treated. But as far as the future goes, nobody knows what tomorrow brings them. But what I would say is that I'm going to do everything that I can and that I'm healthy enough to do relative to continue to add value to society and continue to treat people the same way and try to be creative in business and create new opportunities for other people and new jobs for other people. And just continue to make a difference. We are all going to meet the same fate at some point in time. But to me, the excitement in life is how people look at you, not only while you're alive, but once you've passed, and how important it is to treat people well every day and to try to continue to do things that make a difference to the world and to people.
Lou, thanks so much for sharing that, and just giving us insight, because to some it's a pretty personal question. When you talk about where somebody wants to be, 3, 5, 10 years out, Lou, what would you like your legacy to be, and or if you could leave your family members, your closest family members, with 3 wisdom nuggets, before you were to move on, into the next life, what would those 3 pieces of wisdom be?
I think the answer is simple, and that's be kind to everybody that you meet every day. Always treat people the way you want to be treated, and try to make the world a better place in the time that you have on Earth. And I think if you follow those 3 concepts, it'll make your life fulfilling. It will also help you to be successful in your personal life, but also your business career as well.
Lou, I want to thank you for your time today and for sharing just a small portion of your incredible journey. You know, I'd love to have you back at some point in the future, because you're constantly thinking outside of the box, and you're really setting the bar, you know, for those of us who want to do bigger and greater things in our lives. Lou Weisbach, thank you so much.
Well, Renee, thank you so much for having me, and just want to tell you how much I appreciate you and all of your achievements and your kindness, and I'm so glad to have the time to spend together.
Thank you, Lou. Uh-huh. Hey, before you go, thanks so much for listening. If you got value from this show, chances are your community will too. Please share this link with a friend or mention the podcast on social. That's a big time benefit for us, and hopefully in exchange for providing insight and big ideas to you. I also want to go the extra mile today and give you an opportunity to connect with me further by downloading a free copy of my new book, Down 40 Love: Private Lessons on Turning Adversity into Competitive Advantage. It's my personal manifesto on building resilience in every aspect of your life. Now go put today's episode into practice, because dominance is daily. Are you ready? Let's go.